Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Phil Dierking, and Mario Ritter. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us America's Presidents. But first, here is John Russell.
Recycling businesses are improving processes to remove metals from old batteries. Their hope is to take advantage of an expected shortage of materials, such as cobalt and lithium, when sales of electric cars start rising. The main problem that companies face now is a shortage of used batteries to recycle. But leaders of the recycling industry are sure that the supply and profits will come. Albrecht Melber is co-managing director of the German recycling company Akurek. The value of lithium carbonate and natural and synthetic graphite has doubled or tripled in the last 3 or 4 years, becoming the most valuable materials, besides cobalt, in the automotive battery. There are big values that can be recycled in the future, he told the Reuters news agency. Automobile manufacturers currently sell less than 1 million electric-powered vehicles every year. However, some experts expect electric vehicle sales to pass 14 million a year by 2025. Benchmark Mineral Intelligence is a data specialist group. It predicts the auto industry will need an extra 30,000 tons of cobalt and 81,000 tons of lithium a year to meet demand by 2021. Larry Ray is head of American Manganese, a Canadian recycler of metals. He notes that large lithium-cobalt batteries contain high amounts of valuable minerals. If this equated to mining, you would have a very high-grade feedstock, he said. We're mining batteries, you might say. Mining enough cobalt is a concern for battery manufacturers. Most of the world's cobalt supplies come from the Democratic Republic of Congo, where armed groups operate in areas close to mines. This year, the price of cobalt has more than doubled. Supplies of lithium, mainly mined in Chile, are under far less pressure at this time. Argentina and Australia are likely to increase cobalt production in the near future. However, business leaders are concerned about having enough lithium for use in batteries. Most recyclers heat old batteries to high temperatures to recover metals, a process known as pyrometallurgy. But this generally only produces cobalt and sometimes nickel, while lithium is more difficult and costly to collect. New technology is helping to recover more waste metal from used batteries. Some companies, such as Umicore and Retrieve, say they have developed ways to get lithium once more spent or used batteries are available for recycling. The lack of a steady supply of spent batteries is one of the largest barriers to commercial development, recycling companies say. While sales of electric cars are growing fast, lithium-ion car batteries last 8 to 10 years, on average. This means it will be almost 10 years before the supply of spent batteries is big enough to make the process profitable. American Manganese says it is planning to direct its attention on recovering minerals from faulty batteries. This will help the company get around the wait time for working batteries to lose power. Even if supplies are low, companies seem hopeful about the future. Todd Coy is the vice president of Retrieve. At current commodity prices, we need approximately 4,000 tons per year of batteries to justify the estimated capital costs, he said. That number is more than 3 times its current processing volume. We are confident this volume will be coming in the future, beyond 2023, but the market is not there yet, Coy added. Umicore says it expects volumes of spent batteries to rise above 100,000 tons a year over the next 10 years, with massive volumes coming onto the market around 2025. Once that happens, the chances for the recycling industry to capitalize will take off. I'm John Russell.
Many Americans enjoy spending time with nature, and one popular activity is feeding wild birds. As many as 53 million Americans feed birds as a hobby each year. One of them is Sumner Askin. His interest started when he was in college and studying wildlife science.
I had just taken this class, ornithology, the study of birds, and I was just super into it. And originally I got one feeder and I put it all the way up in this tree. I probably climbed like 30 feet so I could hang it right outside my window. And I got some cool stuff and I just wanted to keep going with it to see what else I could get.
His plan was successful and many wild birds visited his bird feeder. He recalls seeing downy woodpeckers, northern cardinals, mourning doves, and other birds. Askin says he uses several kinds of bird feeders around his home. Most birds, like a small sparrow, can't exactly stand on the side of a tree like a woodpecker can, because the woodpecker gets its toes there and just climbs up. The low-hanging feeder, a normal feeder, they sit on it and they turn sideways and they eat. But that one, they have to hang upside down. Askin works part-time at a store called Wild Birds Unlimited. It sells seed, feeders, and other supplies for people who like to feed birds. Michael Zeiker has operated the store for 26 years. He says feeding birds is good for everyone. He added that a lot of teachers have programs where they create environments for birds in their schools. They do this to teach students about different bird species, how they make their homes, and how to follow them. Zeiker says people like to feed and watch wild birds for many reasons. I think one of the most important reasons is that it's a very, very peaceful emotional experience. You put the food out there, you spend time on your deck in the nice weather. In winter, you're indoors watching birds, and you never know what's going to show up. Most of the yards around can easily get 30 different species of the birds in their backyards. Paul Starzynski started feeding birds as a hobby after he retired 3 years ago. If you sit quietly, they come real close and you don't bother them. You can watch them, he said. You can even see the little seed in their beak before they swallow it. It's kind of fun. Besides, I like them flying over my head. I would be alone out there if I didn't have the birds. I'm Phil Dierking.
Diabetes mellitus is the name for several disorders with one thing in common. There is too much glucose, or sugar, in the blood. The body uses a natural hormone called insulin to change sugar and other food into energy. Diabetes develops when the body does not produce enough insulin or produces none at all. Or it develops when the body cannot use insulin. People living with diabetes often suffer from other health problems. One complication can be damage to tissue on the feet. These foot ulcers can worsen if left untreated. Doctors may decide to remove the damaged area in an operation called an amputation. In some cases, the patient could die. But a device being developed in Britain could help doctors recognize when ulcers are about to form. Using a relatively simple temperature sensing device, doctors scan a patient's feet for signs of an ulcer. The information may help them prevent ulcers from forming, as well as improve the condition of the patient. The scanning device is called the D-FIRST. It works by looking for hot spots or places of higher than normal temperature on the feet of people with diabetes. Doctors believe that hot spots help identify areas of inflammation, which could lead to foot ulcers. Untreated ulcers are a leading cause of diabetes-related amputations. Robert Simpson is a researcher with the National Physical Laboratory near London. He notes that studies have shown a link between amputations and patient survival rates.
If you have an amputation, then unfortunately the outlook is up to 50% of those who have an amputation are dead within 2 years, and up to 80% are dead within 5 years.
Diabetes can cause damage to the nerves of the patient. Nerve damage can limit the patient's ability to feel pain. People living with diabetes may not feel an ulcer developing in its early stages. Using the new scanner, Simpson said, doctors can clearly see areas of inflammation in what he likens to a temperature map.
So what we have here is a thermal imaging camera core. This is sensitive to the infrared, which has a strong relationship with temperature. So this provides you with a temperature map.
The problem of foot ulcers could be bigger than health experts have recognized. A 2014 study by the World Health Organization found that 400 million people live with diabetes. Some estimates say that 25% of patients will develop foot ulcers. Simpson said in Britain, the problem has led to an increase in the number of amputations. There are 140 amputations every single week, so that is nearly one every hour, he noted. He added that 80% of these were driven by foot problems. Researchers say that until recently, doctors looked for hot spots with scanners that could not observe the whole foot. Because of this, problem areas could easily be missed. Simpson said about 100,000 people in Britain have a foot ulcer. He said these people also are likely to develop another ulcer. He said it is important to help them better manage their health problems. The current version of the D-first is held with two hands. Researchers have been testing the scanner for 2 years. Designers hope that later versions of the D-first will be as small as a smartphone. I'm Mario Ritter.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Jimmy Carter. His given name was James, but he liked to be called Jimmy. Carter was elected president in 1976. Until he campaigned for the office, few Americans knew who he was. But Carter said his lack of experience with the federal government made him the best candidate. After witnessing years of problems in the White House, many voters appeared to agree with him. However, Carter's inexperience also became a problem. Some of the issues he faced were complex, and at times, they seemed overwhelming. After only one term, Carter failed to get reelected. But in time, his public image improved. His years after leaving the White House are generally considered more successful than his time in office. Jimmy Carter was born in the southern state of Georgia. He was the oldest of four children. His father was a businessman. His mother was a nurse. The family owned a store, as well as a peanut farm and warehouse. Although the businesses did well, Jimmy Carter grew up very modestly. His family's house did not have electricity or running water. But he was hardworking and wanted to be successful. As a boy, he saved enough money to buy four houses. He earned more money by renting them to other people. He also decided to attend college at the United States Naval Academy, and in time, he did so. Carter was an excellent student, and he became a fine naval officer. As a midshipman, Carter worked on one of the country's first nuclear submarines. He later taught nuclear engineering to other crew members. But Carter's promising career in the Navy ended after only 7 years. His father was dying, and the family farm was in trouble. Carter, his wife, Rosalyn, and their three sons decided to return to Georgia and try to save it. The first years back on the farm were difficult. But in time, the business became successful again. Carter began to turn his attention to other issues. He became involved in his church, local school, hospitals, and libraries. When he had a chance to compete for a position in the state senate, he took it. As a politician, Carter developed an image as an independent thinker who tried to save the government money. He also acted and spoke strongly against racial discrimination. In Georgia at the time, many voters did not agree with Carter's support of racial equality. In 1966, even his own Democratic Party did not choose him to be its candidate to represent Georgia in the U.S. Senate. So Carter began campaigning for the office of state governor instead. In 1970, he was elected. As Georgia's governor, Carter was known as a social and political reformer. However, historian Robert Strong notes that Carter did not always work well with others in his party. Strong teaches at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. He writes that some Georgia lawmakers believed Carter was arrogant. He could appear to think he was morally right, and they were morally wrong. Carter's difficulty in getting along with other officials proved to be one of the problems he would later face. But in the presidential election of 1976, many Americans seemed to like this quality. The little-known governor from Georgia defeated the sitting president, Gerald Ford. Carter won, in part, by saying that he was different than other politicians. He was, he said, a Washington outsider. Then suddenly, Carter was the biggest insider of all, the American president. One of the things Carter wanted to do was change the image of the president. Earlier leaders, such as Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson, had increased the power of the presidency. Nixon had also been shown to be dishonest and resigned from office. Carter promised never to lie to the American people, and on the day of his swearing in as president, he purposefully tried to keep things simple. He walked to the White House from the U.S. Capitol building instead of riding in the back of an automobile. His wife wore clothes that she had worn in public before. The National First Lady's Library notes that her choice of clothing sent a message of an old American value of thrift, or respecting money, and not spending it needlessly. What she wore was meaningful because the country was going through difficult economic times. The Carters wanted to show that the new government would work to cut costs. They also wanted to show that they were there to help the American people, not enjoy the powers of the White House. But in the end, the Carter administration received poor ratings in surveys of public opinion. President Carter had trouble dealing with U.S. lawmakers, even when his party was in control of Congress. One result was that Carter could not advance many of his ideas for legislation. He appeared ineffective. Many historians point out that, in fact, Carter had a number of successes. He helped reduce the country's dependence on foreign oil. He took steps to make the federal government more efficient and to improve the environment. He appointed a number of women and racial minorities to top government jobs, an important move at a time when many were pressing for women's rights and civil rights. And in many cases, Carter supported human rights causes, both in the United States and around the world. But the public generally did not see Carter for his successes. Instead, many Americans blamed him for the country's economic problems. Some also disliked the way he spoke to them. In one speech, Carter blamed the country's troubles on what he called a crisis of confidence. Some listeners were offended. He also decided that the U.S. would not attend the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow. The move was meant to punish the Soviet Union for its involvement in Afghanistan, but many Americans believed the move mostly hurt young American Olympians. The administration also faced other problems. The president was never accused of wrongdoing, but other high-level officials were. So was the president's brother, Billy. As a result, Jimmy Carter's public image for honesty suffered. Then came the Iran hostage crisis. The conflict between the United States and Iran had a long history. One part involved the Shah of Iran. The U.S. government had supported his rise to power, partly because American interests wanted to control Iran's oil. But the Shah severely abused his power. Many Iranians resisted. Some wanted a leader who would more closely obey Islamic teachings. In 1979, under pressure from those Iranians and others, the Shah fled the country. By now, he was suffering from cancer. So, as a humanitarian act, President Carter permitted the Shah to come to the United States for medical treatment. The move made Iranians angry. In protest, a group of students seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, the capital of Iran. They took 90 people, including 66 Americans, hostage. Carter worked hard to get the hostages released. He tried diplomatic negotiations and economic restrictions, but his efforts did not work. Finally, he tried a secret military operation. He sent 8 helicopters and a team of special forces to enter the embassy and rescue the hostages. But that operation failed too. The weather was bad. 3 of the helicopters crashed. 8 Americans were killed. And the public's approval of Jimmy Carter dropped even more. After 444 days, the remaining hostages were released. In exchange, the U.S. government agreed to end some of its economic sanctions against Iran and promised not to interfere in the country's affairs. None of the hostages had been seriously hurt. But the crisis was the final blow to Carter's presidency. A few months before they were released, his effort to seek re-election failed. As president, Carter did not meet the high expectations he had set for himself, and he faced some unusually difficult situations. His presidency also suffered from his problems communicating effectively with Congress, the media, and the American people. But his 4 years as president did leave several marks on the office. For one, he showed that the U.S. president could help other nations and sides resolve their disputes. Carter's best-known success as president was his help negotiating the Camp David Accords. The Accords were a peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. Carter led the talks at Camp David in Maryland. Carter's efforts to protect human rights overseas also influenced the foreign policy of later presidents. In time, his work as a defender of human rights has become his most important legacy. Several years after leaving the presidency, he founded the Carter Presidential Center at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. The center seeks to prevent and resolve conflicts, enhance freedom and democracy, and improve health. In addition to his work there, Carter has helped build houses for people who need them, written books, and negotiated with world leaders to take steps toward peace. In 2002, Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.